Homeowners Association. Appellant's counsel ready to proceed?
May it please the court. My name is Mark Perez. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Dynamic Funding. It's an honor to be here.
Would you like to reserve any rebuttal time?
Yes, I would. I would like to reserve 4 minutes. The meaning of RCW 6.23120 is disputed by the parties. The statute in question creates a second round of bidding opportunities for property sold at an execution to a third party that may make a qualifying offer to purchase the property if the property during the homestead is one that could be declared as a homestead. I'm sorry, if the property during the redemption period could be claimed as a homestead, if the judgment debtor did not redeem the property, and if the underlying foreclosure was not the result of a mortgage or deed of trust foreclosure. These three prerequisites have all been met here. The homestead issue should be clear. The answer in the underlying foreclosure provides that Mrs. Rubano occupied the property for 28 years prior to the date of foreclosure. And the relevant inquiry, according to the statute, is during the period of redemption for any property that a person would be entitled to claim as a homestead. As the court ruled in performance construction.
Is the word homestead ambiguous in that context, given the different rights that that word can confer?
Perhaps, but performance construction answered that question and said that homestead status relates to the specific homestead status at the with the property at issue.
But it can mean a right to possession. It can mean a right to redemption. It can mean an exemption from a forced sale unless a certain upset price is bid.
I disagree with two. A redemption is something separate than homestead rights. And then with regard to exceptions.
Well, a person who is a judgment debtor has a right of redemption.
Correct. And that's under 6.23010, whereas homestead rights are under 6.13. And as far as your question about execution, an ability for an HOA to execute on property that is homestead is different from a judgment debtor's ability to occupy the property as their homestead during the redemption period.
Well, the person who is the subject of the homeowner's foreclosure also has the right of occupation.
And that is usually the judgment debtor, if not a lessee under there, and a lessee perhaps.
And that case that decided that recognized that there isn't just a unified single homestead right. There is a bundle of rights. And the question I have for you, does the legislature's use of the word homestead here tell us clearly that it is one of the bundle or the whole bundle?
That I cannot answer directly, but I would like to point to the Senate bill and the intent to benefit a person who is occupying the property as their homestead, and the fact that the statute is set up such that any excess proceeds generated from a qualifying offer go to the benefit of the judgment debtor.
Okay, let's stop on that. In this situation here, under your scenario, where the bid made by Dynamic is significantly less than the debt that the owner had, how does the owner benefit?
How does the owner benefit?
Where's the benefit to the owner? She still has a note against her.
Your Honor, I invite you to consider the possibility of, or to ignore the specifics of this case, because windfalls are inherent in sheriff sales. And if it were a different set of facts, say that the lien was less than the actual fair market value of the property, then that argument that is presented by the respondents would not be significant here. But in answering your question, It is fair to the homeowner because if this practice were adopted in the mainstream, again, this creates competitive bidding that goes throughout the redemption
community. Can you be seriously telling us it's competitive bidding when it's listed one day and the opportunity to buy is gone the very next day?
Yes.
That's not much of a market.
But anybody could list it. And it needs to be non-exclusive. And so if this were adopted into the mainstream...
anything about the practice that was engaged in here that would encourage people to bid on the property?
Well, Your Honor, if we had made an offer, a redemptioner could make a qualifying offer in theory, as could a judgment debtor. But
any other redemptioner would have had to pay the most recent purchaser the amount of the lien, and the debtor then would have received the benefit of the discharge of that debt. The scenario that your client engaged in has the opposite effect.
True, but if there was a second redemptioner who paid respondent's lien and a qualifying offer did come up, that second redemptioner would be entitled to 120% of that amount. But here, those facts are not present because a redemption is different from a qualifying offer.
Okay, what if we read the statute to identify the purchaser rather than being the purchaser at the sheriff's sale, the most recent purchaser, because under the facts of this case, the owner at the time that your client made its offer was, in fact, a purchaser from a redemptioner, not a subsequent redemptioner.
I think that you need to define purchaser within the larger execution statutes of Chapter 6 of the RCW. And purchaser clearly refers to the sheriff sale purchaser. I refer the court to RCW 6.21100 that says the purchaser ought to receive the sheriff's copy of the sheriff's certificate of purchase. In addition, the statute provides the purchaser shall file the original certificate of sale force with the recording record with the recordings officer. Here, the purchaser is unequivocally, beyond reproach, the HOA because they receive the property via credit bid. Thank you, Your Honor.
About 4 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Julia Phillips, on behalf of Respondent U.S. Bank Trust, as trustee for LSF9 Master Participation Trust. In 2015 and 2016, this court issued published opinions construing RCW 6.231.20, and neither one of these two published cases had the critical right of redemption been exercised by anyone, let alone, as in this case, a deed of trust holder. As set forth in our briefing, the exercise of the important redemption rights alters the applicability of 6.231.20, and if it still applies, it alters the upset price that must be paid under the statutes. Any other ruling under the statute would lead to an absurd or strained result, which, as in the Fulbright case said, you have to look at the entire redemption statutes. It can't lead to an absurd result. And when you look at the legislative intent behind this, it says it's to prohibit real estate speculation and it's to benefit the judgment debtor. Neither one of these would take place if you rule in appellant's favor. As you noted, it could actually harm the judgment debtor because they're probably going to be sued for the difference between the $52,500 and the almost $200,000 that's owed. And this is just going to increase real estate speculation if you allow speculators to undercut the redemption rights. Appellant asked the purchase of property for $52,500, admitting it's worth 2 to 3 times that. And it's undisputed that the debt owned is approximately $196,756.33. And that debt is not, appellant goes on and on to say, well, it was extinguished. The lien was extinguished. The debt is not extinguished. And there's case after case, including the Beal case, Beal Bank versus Sirich, where the Washington Supreme Court said the debt's not extinguished, and the DeYoung versus Cenex case, where they said, again, when you redeem, the amount you have to be paid, and again, your debt's not extinguished, is the amount of the debt and the amount you paid to redeem.
Would you agree your client's not a redemptioner?
Well, if you look at the statute, Your Honor, I think it's irrelevant because RCW 6.23010 says, as used in this chapter, and this is subsection 2, the term judgment debtor, redemptioner, and purchaser also refers to the respective successors in interest. They're the successor in interest to the redemptioner, and the statute...
Isn't the statute more favorable to your client if your client is characterized as a purchaser as opposed to a redemptioner?
In what way?
because of the use of the word purchaser in the statute. And you heard a counsel respond to my question about whether your client is the purchaser referenced in that statute rather than the homeowners association when we're talking about a purchaser who has a lien that is prior to a subsequent purchaser's Part D of 623020.
Right. Under Part D, it says you have to take into account a redemptioner. And under Part
Well, it doesn't just say redemptioner. It also says purchaser.
Right. But RCW 6.23010 says the term purchaser also refers to a successor in interest. And you can only read my client's position.
So can we characterize your client in view of that definition as a purchaser for purposes of D? That's my question.
Yes, absolutely. And again, the appellant makes much of the fact that there's only one purchaser because they get a certificate of purchase. No, that's not correct. You get a certificate of purchase, but when you redeem, you have to give that certificate of purchase back to the sheriff, and the sheriff in turn issues a certificate of redemption, which gets recorded. So this whole thing about the purchaser gets a certificate of purchase, if there's a redemption, the redemptioner steps into the shoes of the purchaser.
Let me ask, when your client purchased the redemption rights from UFC in the first place, did they also purchase the deed of trust and the underlying loan?
Yes, there's an assignment of the deed of trust, which is recorded, which is in the record, and the declaration, which is in the clerk's papers, states that they have the original note. So again, let's look at RCW 6.23120. What does the title of it say? And I'm going to read exactly from it. It says, acceptance of qualifying offer if and only if the property is unredeemed and a deed has been issued. At the time the appellant moved for an order to show cause, one, a deed hadn't been issued. He asked that we be forced to have a deed issued to us, which I don't see under the statute they can do that. But two, it says it only applies if the property is unredeemed. It's clear that the property was redeemed in this case.
You're talking about the title, correct?
Right.
The language itself, though, is limited to if the property is redeemed by the judgment debtor.
Right, but why would they say unredeemed, and then why would they only refer to, when you look at the amount that must be paid, it only refers to 6.23020, and that statute, as the Washington practice says, the amount that must be paid to the purchaser.
We have a lot of cases that say we don't look at the title, and there are a lot of statutes that the last section of this chapter says that the chapter headings and the titles are not part of the statutes. What do we do with that?
Well, it's not just the title. It's the fact that the statute says you have to look at RCW 6.23020 to see how much needs to be paid. That statute says the amount you pay the purchaser.
That's a little different argument.
Right.
You've got one argument that this whole statutory scheme doesn't apply, and a second argument that they didn't offer enough money. Seems to me that 020 supports your argument they didn't offer enough money, but it doesn't help you with the whole statutory scheme doesn't apply because there was a redemption.
Well, why didn't the legislature say RCW 6.23040? And the Fulbright case said you can't look at 020 without looking at 040. It says you have to look at the overall redemption scheme. So if it does apply, I think it doesn't apply because it wasn't redeemed and the statute doesn't reference 6.23020. And the Washington practice says there's two redemption amounts that have to be paid, one to the purchaser, one to a redemptioner. But let's, for the sake of argument, say that RCW 6.23120 does apply. In that case, the appellant's trying to read it with just subsection A, 2A and B. Subsection C says any sum paid by the purchaser, and again, a redemptioner steps into the shoes of a purchaser, on a prior lien secured by an interest of the property, to the extent the payment was necessary to the protection of the judgment debtor or a redemptioner. So right
but
there...
But we don't have that here, though. There's no record of any payments made on the underlying lien.
No, it says to the extent the payment is necessary for the protection of the debtor or the redemptioner. Right. They did make a payment. And
why do we need 040? Given your earlier reference to the statute that would seem to permit characterizing a redemptioner as a purchaser in the context of subpart D, since successors in interest are characterized as potentially as purchasers. It seems to me the legislature didn't need to refer to 030. We just have a shifting down the line. As somebody acquires a property, they'd enter in the shoes of the purchaser, mm-hmm. and the person that wants to come in and pay money is the prospective redemptioner. The whole scheme works then. It provides the protection of 030, and it prevents the windfall that has been sought by appellants in this case.
Correct. If you interpret...
So why do we need to go through all the rest of this folderol?
Well, again, it's because the title says, you know, unredeemed, and it doesn't mention what needs to be... It mentions 020, but not 040, which is... I think there's a reason for that, but... We can go with what you said, and there's not a reason, and you can just look at 020. If you interpret the statute the way that the appellant wants it to, or the respondent wants to be interpreted, it works exactly as the legislature intended. You take the debt, 196, and you add 120%, be about $239,000, and the judgment debtor, as the legislature intended, would get money after they lost their house, and that's the intent of this statute.
And they also would not be exposed to a lawsuit on the
exactly.
underlying debt.
In this case, they're actually going to be harmed, because if my client has to sell a property for $52,000, which is owed $196,000, the incentive is there to go after the judgment debtor on the note. And that's what they will do in this case and other cases.
And is there any incentive for the bank, under this scenario, for a bank to ever loan to somebody that has a condo association?
No. And there's no incentive to redeem, which, again, the Fulbright case talks about the importance of the redemption right. It refers to it as second bite of the apple, but it also specifically states, the purpose of redemption is to provide a mechanism for subordinate property holders to save their interest in the property. If you interpret it the way the appellant does, what are they saving? They're saving nothing. It discourages redemption, discourages lending in the case of an HOA, and it nullifies 6.120, completely swallows the entire redemption statute as far as the important right of redemption. Secondly, as to the homestead issue, just very briefly, this for 8 years, and at the time of the lawsuit, was owned by a trust. The deed of trust was executed by a trust. The fact that 1 month before they quitclaimed it back to them as an individual so that they could claim a homestead shouldn't be dispositive. That's form over substance. The substance was for 8 years the property is owned as a trust, and the Glenn case says only a natural person can claim a homestead.
Thank you.
Counsel.
May it please the court. First off, purchaser does not. When you look at 6.23010 and the successors in interest, they say nothing about purchasers. Second, as far as the title is concerned, the more specific language in the body of the statute should dictate how the title is interpreted. And the title was mentioned as an afterthought and was not included in the original Senate bill. As far as whether or not...
Well, do we know who drafted the title? Was it the legislature or was it the code reviser when it was... allocated to a section of the RCWs?
I know that it was not the legislature, and you can look at my second declaration that includes the Senate bill in there and confirm that it's
the title. Why don't you address a more fundamental question, and that is, how does the result that you're urging upon us further what appears the legislature's intent through redemption statutes in this scheme was?
Well, if the intent is to avoid speculation, and if the intent is to generate excess funds for judgment debtors, and if the theory is that this becomes a mainstream tactic in share sale purchases, then in theory it should generate more competitive bidding, and anything in excess would go towards the judgment debtor. Now, I ask again that you not limit...
Well, the facts of this case would suggest just the opposite, wouldn't they?
But the facts of this case are not always true. And so, again, windfalls are inherent in share of sale executions. Had they had a lien for $50,000 and they redeemed and the property is worth $150,000, they would receive $100,000 and I would be making the argument they receive. But the legislative intent is clear based on the plain language. And if you were to substitute purchaser as the successor in interest of their deed of trust into subsection 0.020C and subsection point D, it would not make sense, because subsection C refers to a purchaser who pays a lien to protect the property. So you would ask yourself, respondents, as the purchasers, did they pay their own lien? Of course they didn't. So subsection C does not apply. For subsection D, it would be if a redemptioner redeems from a purchaser who is also a creditor. And so if they are redeeming from themselves, you're contorting the statute, and subsection D does not apply. It's more easy to read the statute and say subsection D applies when the purchaser is a lien holder other than one that was foreclosed on that resulted in the sheriff's sale. And I think it would be more consistent to let the statute flow in that if there is a successive redemption, then a qualifying offeror would have to pay 120% of that amount. And so if this was did create a system of competitive bidding, there is a less chance of windfall for any party. And because a qualifying offer would have to meet a certain threshold before it becomes before it doesn't make any economic sense. There will be a bottom line, and people will get to that bottom
line. Explain that more fully to me, because
what I mean, Your Honor, is that suppose there were three qualifying offers, and they said, well, the property value is $142,000, and my expenses so far will be $20,000. It could go up all the way to $120,000, and anything in excess of the redemption amount would go to the judgment debtor. And so although this statute is still in its nascency as far as its application in sheriff sale purchasing, it does have the opportunity to prevent speculation if there is actual more competitive bidding. And again,
doesn't your interpretation encourage last-minute sharp dealing?
It does, but that's how it's been applied.
The other interpretation prevents that.
It does not. Because, again, there's nothing that says that a bank won't go and won't file a breach of contract claim regardless of if they get the property.
But they still are going to have to credit what they got from the property.
So that I have no idea what banks do.
All right. Well, the law may have something to say, but thank you, counsel.
You're welcome. The plain language of the statute rules here.
You've completed your argument. Our last case is